Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Summer for me, like the autumn leaves you changed, and the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you. And the winter winds blew in, and now I'm over you.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Brad Williams? Y'all like Brad? Brad Williams fronts the acclaimed feel-good country band The Salty Dogs, whose music has been featured on TLC's Trading Spaces and HBO's Rectified. More can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Garland County Library in beautiful Hot Springs, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. So what do y'all think about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each week we feature an artist. So tonight's featured artist is Xu Long Wah from Shanghai, China, who now lives right here in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and Xu Long at his website, Xu, which is xuinternationalart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's storytellers are all from right here in Hot Springs, Arkansas, and they tell stories of split-second decisions. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Ben Burton's decision is one he lives to regret. And we'll end the night with Gordon Smith, a game, and his brother's quick thinking. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South on the lake with Corey Roberts and her decision that saved a life in Every Girl Needs a Sister.
The sun was warm on my face and shoulders as I climbed back into the boat. I unsteadily walked to where my pile of things was and found my ratty old ball cap. I pulled it roughly over my head. The fishy smell of the lake was in the air and it covered me. Just one more reminder of my continual failure at water skiing. My family, an older cousin in particular, seemed to think it was their personal mission in life to get me up on those stupid skis. We would try Saturday after Saturday. It will build confidence, they would say. Well, what was happening to my confidence in the meantime? My chunky 12-year-old stature was already getting a self-esteem beating in middle school Monday through Friday. Silly me, I thought I might have a break during the summer. From my seat in the back of the boat, I watched my older cousin Rick put down the throttle. As we picked up speed to find a new place on the lake, I was thankful it was too loud to talk, and I was able to become completely lost in my thoughts. I scanned the boat. Rick's body was golden, perfectly symbolic of the fact that he was the golden child of the family. Not only was he the oldest and already the built-in measuring stick by which the rest of us were compared to, he was polite, athletic, and well-liked. Everyone wanted to be his friend, and he treated everyone like they already were. In addition, I would get constant reminders and pep talks from family that he was also husky at my age, but he turned it around. A former fatty. He was everything I wanted to be. I was enamored by and completely jealous of him. I would do anything for his approval, and it killed me that I literally could not ski to get it. Rick never traveled without a posse. Today, he had just one of his groupie friends with him. David was pale and tall with a little gut. He was slotted to go into the Navy when the summer was over. I couldn't decide if David, too, was wrapped up with Rick because he genuinely liked him or if he wanted to be him. Also in the boat was my ridiculously sweet mom, who regularly encouraged me and praised me, but holding her big floppy hat and bouncing as we flew over the wakes, I could tell even she was getting weary of my unsuccess. Sitting at the bow like a loyal golden retriever was my little sister, Suzanne. She was, in many ways, like that loving and gentle breed of dog. Her hair had the same glistening, healthy color and identical waves. She mooned over me and made me feel important when the rest of the world didn't. She was so unlike me, though. Her large, colorful life jacket highlighted that she was delicate and tiny. Golden, like Rick. She was adorable, and everyone fawned over her while I felt like the wart of the nose on our family. I didn't always think of her like that. I used to consider us as equals in the family. I thought about the morning she was born. I was 5 years old, and I couldn't sleep. I was too excited. And as we drove to the hospital, the intense pinks and oranges in the sunrise were like no colors I had ever seen before. When I saw her for the first time, I burst back into the waiting room, filled with family and friends, and announced, "She's amazing!" We lived so far in the country that she was my only playmate. I usually ran around bare-chested with my hair a tangled mess, while she believed strongly in wearing frilly dresses because, after all, that's what makes you a girl. Despite our differences, we were the best of friends. But when my body started changing, so did our relationship. I was becoming more awkward while she continued to stay adorable and win everyone's affections. For that reason, I was growing to be more indignant towards her. Her differences from me while we were younger were cute. Now they just highlighted where I was lacking. Rick slowed the boat down and Suzanne pointed to a spot. It was her turn. This summer, she had blossomed into queen of the kneeboard, which I couldn't do successfully either. Every Saturday, the boat full of people would remain tight-lipped when I climbed in, but always openly delighted in Suzanne's kneeboarding triumphs. I didn't feel up to hearing that again, but what choice did I have? I was stuck in the middle of the water. Rick grinned ear to ear as the two golden children worked together, getting the lines ready and the kneeboard out. As Suzanne did a dainty cannonball off the side of the boat, I rolled my eyes while everyone giggled. She lay on top of the kneeboard, grabbed the rope handle with one hand, and gave Rick a big thumbs up with the other. As the boat picked up speed, the line tightened. Like a pro, Susie pulled herself up on the board with one hand, pulled the strap, and Velcroed it tight over her folded legs. And the show began. Of course, the great and wonderful Rick would never drive recklessly or try to throw her off going this speed, and Susie could kneeboard all day. The wind tried to lift my hat off my head. I caught it and held it tightly in place. As I looked out over the lake, I began to daydream again. The lake was practically empty, with the exception of one boat. It must be because school was about to start. We were going over that boat's wakes when I heard my mom shout, "Oops, she's off," signaling to Rick to turn around and get Suzanne. The wake had taken her down. Rick was turning the boat around, but something wasn't right. From far away, we could see the kneeboard remain upside down in the water with Susie trapped underneath. She was usually much quicker in getting unstrapped into the surface. "She should be up by now. She should be up," Mom started exclaiming anxiously. Time moved slowly as we continued to approach the kneeboard. Rick and David continued to assure Mom that she'll be up any second, as Mom and I inspected every inch of the kneeboard as we approached. I could not take the uncertainty any longer. I moved to the front of the boat where Susie was just sitting a few minutes ago. When Rick put the boat in neutral and we were in the vicinity, I dove off the bow like some husky version of Baywatch. I got to Suzanne, who was still ensnared by the kneeboard strap. I found the strap underwater and released her. We reached the surface together. With my arm around her, I swam her to the ladder of the boat while she coughed and cried. I was the golden child that day. Rick had disappointed us all. It should have been him to dive in, or Navy recruit David. Even my mom was frozen in fear, but satisfaction wasn't what I felt. While everyone fussed over Susie in the boat, I stayed in the water a while longer and cried myself. I almost lost her. No matter the little things that bugged me or the petty jealousies I felt, I knew in that moment I would have died for her. That thought took me over, and I wept as I swam out to retrieve the kneeboard. My sister and I have grown into two very different people. There are days when I feel like I don't even know who she is. When I start to feel indifferent about our relationship or her, I think back to that day. I would still dive in after her. I would still sacrifice myself for her. My love for her is as fierce as it was that day.
Corey M. Roberts is a wife to Brent Roberts, children's minister at First Baptist here in Hot Springs, and mother of two girls. She is also a preschool music teacher and an aspiring author. Next on Tales from the South, the plan is hatched, and Ben Burton must choose the high or low road in The Martyrdom of Andy.
Andy was a sweet, amusing guy whom everyone liked, yet harassed, just because that's the way one treated Andy Drake. He took the kidding well, Andy always smiled back with those great big eyes that seemed to say, "Thank you, thank you, thank you," with each sweeping blink. For us fifth graders, Andy was our outlet. He was our whipping boy. He even seemed grateful to pay the special price for a membership in our group. Andy Drake don't eat no cake, and his sister don't eat no pie. If it wasn't for the welfare dole, all the Drakes would die. Andy even appeared to appreciate this sing-song parody of Jack Sprat. The rest of us really enjoyed it, bad grammar and all. I do not know why Andy had to endure this special treatment to earn our friendship and membership in the group. It just evolved naturally, no plan or discussion. I don't recall anyone ever mentioning in this connection that Andy's father was in prison or that his mother took in washing and men or that Andy's ankles, elbows, and fingernails were always dirty and his old coat was way too big. We soon wore all the fun out of those. Andy never fought back. Snobbery blossoms in the very young, I guess. It's plain now that the group attitude was that it was our right to belong, but that Andy was a member by our sufferance. Despite all that, we all liked Andy until that day, until that very moment. He's different. We don't want him, do we? Which one of us said it? I wanted to blame Randolph all these years, but I cannot honestly say who spoke those trigger words that brought out the savagery lying dormant but so near the surface in all of us. It doesn't matter who, for the fervor with which we took up the cause revealed us all. But I didn't want to do what we did. For years, I tried to console myself with that. Then one day, I stumbled on the unwelcome but irrefutable words that convicted me forever. Quote, "The hottest corners of hell are reserved for those who, during a moment of crisis, maintain their neutrality." This weekend was to be like others the group had enjoyed together. After school on a Friday, we would meet at the home of one of the members, mine this time, for a camp out in the nearby woods. Our respective mothers, who did most of the preparation for these safaris, fixed an extra pack for Andy, who was to join us after chores. We quickly made camp, mother's apron strings forgotten. With individual courage now amplified by the group, we were now men against the jungle. The others decided that since it was my party, I should be the one to give Andy the news. I who had long believed that Andy secretly thought a little more of me than he did the others, this because of the puppy-like way he looked at me. I, who often felt Andy revealing his love and appreciation with those huge, wide-open eyes. I can still plainly see Andy as he came toward me down the long, dark tunnel of trees that leaked only enough of the late afternoon light to kaleidoscope changing patterns on his soiled old sweatshirt. Andy was on his rusty, one-of-a-kind bike, a girl's model, with sections of garden hose taped around the rims for tires. He appeared excited and happier than I'd ever seen him, this frail little guy who had been an adult all his life. I knew he was savoring the acceptance by the in group, this first chance to belong, to have boy fun, to do boy things. Andy waved to me as I stood in the camp clearing awaiting him. I ignored his happy greeting. He vaulted off the funny old bike and trotted over toward me, full of joy and conversation. The others, concealed in the tent behind me, were silent, but I felt their support. Why don't he get serious? Can't he see that I'm not returning his cheer? Can't he see by now that his euphoria is not reaching me? Then suddenly he did see. His innocent countenance opened even more, leaving him entirely vulnerable. His whole demeanor said, "It's going to be very bad, isn't it, Ben? Let's have it." Well practiced in facing disappointment, he didn't even brace for the blow. And he never fought back. Incredulously, I heard myself say, "Andy, we don't want you." Hauntingly vivid still is the stunning quickness with which two huge tears sprang into Andy's eyes and just stayed there. Vivid because of a million maddening reruns for that scene in my mind. The way Andy looked at me, frozen for an eternal moment. What was it? It wasn't hate. Was it shock? Was it disbelief? Or was it pity for me? Or forgiveness? Finally, a fleet little tremor broke across Andy's lips and he turned without appeal or even a question to make the long, lonely trip back home in the dark. As I turned and entered the tent, someone, the last one of us to feel the full weight of moment, started the old doggerel. "Andy Drake don't eat no cake, and his sister don't." Then it was unanimous. No vote taken, no word spoken, for we all knew we had done something horribly, cruelly wrong. We were swept over by the delayed impact of dozens of lessons and sermons. Each of us heard perhaps for the first time, "Inasmuch as you do it unto the least of these." In that long, hushed, heavy moment, we gained an understanding new to us then, but indelibly fixed in our minds. We had destroyed an individual made in the image of God with the only weapons for which we had no defense, and we had no excuse, rejection. And his poor attendance in school made it difficult to tell when he actually withdrew. But one day it dawned on me that he was gone forever. I had spent too many days struggling within myself to find and to polish a proper way of telling Andy how witheringly ashamed and sorry I was and am. I now know that to have hugged Andy and to have cried with him and even to have joined with him in a long silence would have been enough. It may have healed us both. I never saw Andy Drake again. I have no idea where he went or where he is, if he is. But to say I haven't seen Andy is not entirely accurate. In the decades since that autumn day in the Arkansas woods, I've encountered thousands of Andy Drakes. My conscience places Andy's mask over the face of every disadvantaged person with whom I come in contact. Each stares back at me with the same haunting and expectant look which became fixed in my mind that day long ago. And my letter. "Dear Andy Drake, the chance you will ever see the word these words is quite remote, but I must try. It is much too late for this confession to purge my conscience of guilt. I neither expect nor want it to. But I do pray for my little friend of long ago is that you might somehow learn of and be lifted by knowing of the continuing force of your sacrifice. What you suffered at my hands that dreadful day and the grace you showed in response has been twisted, turned, and molded by God into a blessing. I hope this knowledge might ease the memory of that terrible day for you. I've been no saint, Andy, nor have I done all the things I could and should have done with my life. But what I yearn for you to know is that I have never again knowingly betrayed an Andrew Drake, nor, I pray, shall I ever love Ben.
A former coach and industrial manager, Ben Burton took early retirement to pursue a career as a speaker and writer. Even after two books and a weekly column, Ben considers Andy his first and best. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Gordon Smith's brother's quick decision ends up in their family lore in Hide and Seek.
What I'm going to tell you actually happened. My brother himself wrote this story in his journal, and he even had the courage to tell his sons about it before they were old enough to read what he had written. I hope you'll forgive me for any embellishments that have arisen over the past 70 years. He is no longer with us to make corrections. There were four boys in our family and no girls. This one-sided gender arrangement had a lot to do with what kind of games we played. When the family sat around at night talking, you remember when we used to do that, before TV came along, we played many different table games, including flinch, rook, gin rummy, checkers, Chinese checkers, casino, crokinole, and canasta, of course. We made a stab at chess, but that didn't last long. But it was outdoors where we young hellions preferred to be, and it was the active game that we liked to pursue. Boy Scouts' regular competition at meetings included some rather rough games, such as capture the flag, steal the bacon, cranes and crows. On camping trips, unsuspecting victims had to be indoctrinated in the good old snipe hunt. When we had enough to make up two decent teams, we had the traditional sports in season, of course, football, basketball, and baseball. My next older brother and I were grouped closest together by birth order. And when we were able to play outside, we were very imaginative. Robin Hood attracted us to the bow and arrow, which we constructed for ourselves out of a thin piece of wood and a piece of string and those weeds that grew with the knobs on the end of them. When our interest turned to Superman, the Man of Steel, my mother made us red capes to give us that extra lift. Climbing every tree in the yard was a great challenge. There were several different types of trees of various sizes and shapes and limb arrangements in our yard, and each one represented something in which we were interested. Now, this was during World War II. The elm might have been the cockpit in a heavy bomber. The pecan might have been the bridge of a Navy destroyer, and the oak might have been a PT boat. In all of our tree climbing, we never took a serious fall, but there were a few scars from rough bark and limbs. But there had to be inside games for rainy days. Inside at our house equated with quiet and calm. Mother's nerves would not allow any running and hollering in the house. When she was away, we were free to run and yell and bounce on the beds, but when she was home, and we had to play inside because of the bad weather, we were a lot more limited in the scope of our games, and hide-and-seek, probably the only acceptable one. This was the 40s. My father had built our house mostly by himself. Lumber was scarce and expensive, and so we got by with just enough space for the six of us. Because our house was relatively small, we were and greatly hampered when we played hide-and-seek. Places to tuck ourselves away, especially after the fifth or sixth game, when we were out of hiding places. Now, I mentioned earlier that we accumulated a few scars while climbing trees. My brother managed a Lulu one time when we were playing inside the house on a very rainy day. Mother was in residence, and she had forbade us to go outside to play. That's a requirement that must have hurt her as much as it did us. And we sat around trying to think of some exciting game to play that would let us move around the house without disturbing her, but would still have some degree of competitiveness. The longer we sat figuring, the more depressed we became, and it seemed certain that the rain had set in for the whole day. Now, if we'd had any friends around, we probably would not have had the nerve to settle for hide and seek. That was too tame. It bordered on the effeminate, in our opinion. And of course, the house was awfully small. But what else was left? As long as we stayed out of the cook's way, we could manage a fairly decent competition with some imagination. So Not It took off while It counted to 100. Or at least he said it was 100. It was a mighty short count sometimes. And then he announced loudly, "Ready or not, here I come." As I said earlier, our house was not a mansion, but there were nooks and crannies that boys could make use of in these relatively small quarters, and we knew where they were. We'd been exploring all of them at Christmas time, looking for those presents that were hidden away. And so we had a fairly entertaining game that rainy day for about an hour, and then the fun really started. Now, I don't count what I did as cheating, really. I thought it was pretty smart. Well, I think it was ingenious, is what I think. When it was my turn to hide, I made a big show of going toward the only bathroom in the house. And I knew that he would be peeking through his fingers as he counted to see which way I went. But he couldn't quite see around the corner all the way to the bathroom. I just headed out in that direction. I slammed the bathroom door from the outside, and then I hid behind the couch. When my brother finished the short count and announced that he was coming after me, ready or not, of course, the first place he checked was the bathroom. And since Mother was the only other person in the house and he could see her at the stove, when he saw the closed door, he assumed that I was in the bathroom. So he settled down outside the door to wait me out. Or he tried to settle down. It happened that we had not slowed down in our game long enough for him to visit the bathroom. And now that he was unable to do so, of course, it seemed more urgent for him to go. And I was watching the whole episode, peering around the end of the couch, bouncing from one foot to the other, unable because of the rain to do what most boys would have done and just go outside. He became very desperate, and Mother running water in the sink didn't help any either. And the bathroom door was still closed, and he heard nothing to indicate that I was about ready to come out of there, and that made his plight even more desperate. Well, it so happened that the sleeping porch was next to the bathroom, and its floor had a sizable knot hole in one of the planks. One of us had knocked the center out of the knot hole, leaving an opening through the floor to the crawl space under the house. And our house had no underpinning, so that area was open in turn to the yard. And in the yard, our chickens were free to run. My desperate brother waited as long as he could, and then he spied the hole in the floor, and he decided that any port in the storm would have to do. And making sure that Mother was still at the stove, he lay down on the floor over the hole and unbuttoned, and well, you get the picture. Except for one more brush stroke. There was a big old red rooster on the ground under that hole looking for his supper. And he looked up at the floor of the house. He must have thought that he had found the mother load of worms. When my brother started screaming, "Something's got me!" Mother came running in, and to her credit, she didn't laugh along with me. But from then on, it seemed that she hummed the song, "She'll be coming around the mountain when she comes," an awful lot with this wry smile on her face, especially when she came to the part that said, "We will kill the old red rooster."
Gordon Smith is a retired public school science teacher living in Hot Springs with his wife, Carol, a retired English and journalism teacher. He is a native Mississippian, and she was born and raised in Jonesboro, Arkansas. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Garland County Library. Thank you to Bubba's Catfish for providing dinner. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by William F. Lehman Public Library. And our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
There was someone that was trying to agitate my grandmother, and she said, "You know, I'm getting too old to fight." Was the song, so here it is.
They sense a lack of communication. I need some time to get away. Sail away and take a long vacation. And we'll dream a better day. And all these fears and these feelings I've held inside, and I'm getting too old to fight it. I tell you the truth, sometimes I wear a thin disguise, and I'm getting too old to hide it. And I'm getting too old to fight. Look at the mess we've undertaken. The silence says all we want to say. No more meaningful conversation. Feel our love is slipping away. And all these fears and these feelings I've held inside, and I'm getting too old to fight it. I tell you the truth, sometimes I wear a thin disguise, and I'm getting too old to hide it. And I'm getting too old to fight. And all these fears and these feelings I've held inside, and I'm getting too old to fight.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. and the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at BakerHouseNLR.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at InfraredStudioProductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern-style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.